All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. Once again, I am Colin alongside Dom. Dom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing very well. And today's episode is going to be something totally different. We should set this up right away at the beginning. What we are going to be doing today is another episode going through the very beginning of Survivor Heroes versus Villains. We're finally, after spending an hour and 45 minutes already going through the cast and the pre-gaming, finally going to be getting into the actual footage from the season itself. A ton to be getting to today. But what we're going to be doing, as I'm guessing a lot of people who are hearing this, by the time they are hearing this, will have figured out, is this episode and this episode alone, we are actually going to put out as a free sample to the general public. The patrons are going to get it exactly a week before the general public did. But for the people who are not normal patrons, but are somehow here, not somehow, of course, we are deliberately letting you hear this, but for those people, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us and for being interested in at least the early minutes of this Heroes versus Villains rewatch. We're going to be doing this all Survivor offseason long, and we're going to be, you know, whenever Heroes versus Villains is done, we're going to be moving on to another kind of classic CBS seasons that the regular patrons are going to continue to get to pick the order of. So we thought it would be worthwhile to put out a free part of this podcast and see if we can spark a little extra interest, because I think a lot of people would enjoy coming along for the ride with us.
And this episode, it's the premiere of the season, and this really sets a tone for everything to come afterwards. So hopefully this episode of ours will set the tone for everything to come, and you can use that to judge whether you're picking up what we're putting down.
Right. And so Dom is using the word episode in a very loose sense here. We are not going to get through the entire first episode of Heroes versus Villains, or even close today. The way the patron rewatch podcasts are going to be working from this point forward is we're going to do about an hour, figure out where we are and where it would make sense to wrap up from there, and then resume the next time. And the plan for today is we're hopefully going to be able to make it through the opening 15 to 25 minutes, depending on how long it takes. And by that, I mean the intro where everyone flies in on the helicopters, they get to talk to Jeff on the mat, and then the very first challenge where they're digging through the sand and wrestling with each other. That is the goal for today, and we'll see how far into that we can make it. I'm optimistic that we can at least be coming close. But for the people who want more, that, as I mentioned, is going to be continuing all off season long. And by the time the regular public is actually able to hear this, because of the week buffer that we're going to put in there for releasing this for the patrons and for the general public, if you are someone who is interested in hearing more of this, good news, everyone. Part one is already up on Patreon, and by the time this is being released, part three will have actually been released today on Patreon. So patreon.com/Dom and Colin is where you would want to go if you want to come along for the rest of the ride here. All right, Dom, any other whoring that you want to do before we dive into the actual premiere of Heroes versus Villains?
I didn't have anything at this stage. I think it's a little too pessimistic to say we might only get to the first challenge. As regular patrons will know who have listened to that introductory podcast already, this is a season of positivity, and I'm optimistic that we can set our sights higher than that and truly reach for the stars here.
That's right. Dom, thank you for bringing that up. For the people who have not listened already to the earlier patron podcast, this is we are both going to make a concerted effort after spending the last few regular CBS Survivor seasons a little more down on the show than we generally like to be. Heroes versus Villains is going to officially be the season of positivity from Dom and Colin. And actually, I guess, Dom, with that in mind, let's start off here with the first thing I wanted to get into from the premiere, where we get this fantastic intro of Jeff Probst talking over the clips of the locations and a few cast members from the previous seasons. And it's fantastic stuff, and it really does do a good job of getting you amped up for the season. But I did notice, I don't want this to be interpreted as negative, because this is the season of positivity, but I thought it was interesting, at least, to note Jeff Probst sounds a little bit different than he does today. His voiceover, I don't know if you picked up on the same thing, it sounds slightly toned down a little bit. He's not nearly as animated, I would say, as he is during the modern intros.
It absolutely does. He's not yelling into the camera Dan Giesling style here, but everything else more than makes up for that. You don't need Jeff just inserting hype into the equation here when there is so much just building naturally based on everything else that's going on around it. And I've heard this season and it's just overall feel and aesthetic described as cartoonish, and I think that really hits the mark. Like, everything is so over the top and so just fun and enjoyable that the fact that Jeff is sounding like he's a little bit more muted than usual really takes nothing away from that whatsoever.
Well, I think one of the criticisms we have of modern Survivor, is, and cartoonish is probably a good word to use for it, is the way that they try to sell us on the split between millennials versus Gen X, or heroes versus healers versus hustlers. And it's possible, I can't think of a season before this other than like the racial divide, which I don't think was explicitly pitted as like white people against Asian people, against black people and Hispanic people. I think the heroes versus villains, like deliberately saying here is one group with these attributes versus another group with this set of attributes. While as you know, as much credit as the season gets, and obviously deservedly so, this may have been the starting off point for Survivor feeling like that was a good thing to do.
I think there is something to that, and you know that 15 seasons later, by the time you get to heroes versus healers versus hustlers, rather than heroes versus villains, you've taken a definite wrong turn somewhere along the road. But this, I'm perfectly fine with them just introducing the theme, at least for this season, because it is the natural theme. It is what every storyline, every narrative is naturally built around. Every story, every narrative has heroes, it has villains, it has maybe some characters who blur that boundary and who sit on the fence and are sometimes heroic and sometimes villainous. No season has hustlers versus healers. That's just a completely artificial concept that no one has ever given voice to before someone came up with it at 12 p.m. the night before casting had to be locked in the production room. So this, I understand your point here, and I think it definitely has gone too far, but heroes versus villains is more than fine with me. And I think having that division, and everyone is so willing to play into it, that makes the season that much more better versus just it being all stars two with some much looser theme.
No, I'm certainly with you on that. And I also think potentially one place that people may almost find it cartoonish, but at least for me, as someone who just watched this for the first time since I don't remember the last time I rewatched Heroes versus Villains, but I'm going to say it was right around like 2011 or 2012. I got so goddamn amped up seeing those choppers come out from behind the clouds and enter the shot, and all the way through when Jeff Probst is later saying 39 days, 20 people, one survivor, and the choppers come out like perfectly timed right over him as the waves come crashing on the beach. I do understand that may come across as cartoonish, or like, I don't know if heavy-handed is the right word, but for me that stuff sincerely works in this context when they do have the kind of cast and theme to back it up.
Absolutely. And as I said before, this was a season that got me into Survivor, and part of that was this was my first episode of the show I watched, and there's this incredible opening sequence. And Jeff said in his blog for this episode, and he did weekly blogs during the season, and we'll definitely reference those from time to time as appropriate. But
one of us will reference those from time to time, for the record.
I put most of the legwork in here in case it wasn't clear already. But one of the many points that Jeff made was, if you took this opening sequence, you showed this first 15 or 20 minutes to some stranger, some random guy on the street who has never seen the show before, doesn't know the concept, doesn't know who any of these people are, they would want to know, they would want to find out, they would be hooked in, and I want to keep watching. And I was that person at one point, and it hooked me in, and I'm still here now doing this here with you. So Jeff is definitely on the money about that.
Yeah, actually, one question that I have for you, Dom, as you were watching this for the first time, for anyone unaware, Dom initially got into Survivor because after the end of Heroes versus Villains, and correct me if I'm getting any of this story wrong, Dom, you heard about the controversy with like the way the jury vote fell between the finalists, and went back, and Heroes versus Villains was the first season you ever watched. And I'm wondering what you knew, if anything, about any of these players other than Russell as you were watching this opening montage for the first time.
I knew basically nothing. I had heard the names Sandra and Parvati thrown around in that controversy, so I had some idea that those were going to be big players in the season. But other than that, I came in completely blind, and also completely blind to the concept of Survivor. So this was really throwing myself in at the deep end, and I'm so glad I did, because the show, I clearly love the show enough that I think wherever I had started, I would have circled around here eventually and fallen in love with the show, whatever order I'd seen it in. But it made a very good elevator pitch for itself with this first 10 or 15 minutes here.
So as everyone's coming in, and we start actually hearing from the players. Rupert, of course, is going to be the one who gets the opening confessional, which to the people who are familiar with the franchise, I think the Vegas line would have been roughly like the Warriors in the NBA Finals this year, where like you have to risk $1,000 to win $100 if you want to bet that Rupert is going to obviously be the person who gets the first confessional. But to you, Dom Harvey, did you even know what a Rupert was when you were watching this?
I had no idea, and part of me here in 2018 wishes I still had no idea, but Rupert, for as much as I might not enjoy his character or understand why everybody was so madly in love with him, it's a no-brainer to have him open the show here. And in keeping with the over-the-top cartoonish atmosphere, Rupert plays into that so perfectly, and he absolutely delivers on that front.
Totally, yeah. And we get Rupert really establishing the hero's end of this situation, where he says, in my world, I've always tried to show that good will win. I will not be doing Rupert impressions, by the way. Over there, that's the one and only Rupert impression. I have suddenly decided that that's no longer going to be happening. And Rupert really, of course, over the course of the first decade of this franchise's run, is the defining hero still, as we talked at least in some detail about in our cast preview. And then it cuts immediately by the second confessional, and the first villain confessional is Russell, who again, we are hot in the Survivor world at this point off the heels of Samoa, and Russell is all anyone is really talking about up until like the Heroes versus Villains cast gets announced. And Russell, I think, does a great job of being that antithesis to Rupert, where his opening confessional to set up the villains, where he says, I'm a villain, I think villains are smarter than heroes because they don't mind stabbing someone in the back to get where they want.
It's a fact, it's a proven fact, Google it.
And I feel like, Dom, this is a perfect example of what makes Russell so good at the entertainment aspect of it to me. Because I feel like for most people, we would get the beginning of that confessional where he talks about, I'm a villain, and I think that's going to be beneficial to me because I'm willing to screw over whoever it takes, essentially. But I think what makes Russell so good and what I enjoy so much about him is that last sentence that he always tacks on. The it's a fact, it's a proven fact, Google it. It's almost Trump-esque, but I feel like in this capacity, it's a very good thing.
And that's a sentence I could happily import into my everyday life. Like, I wish I could just quote that clip at people whenever I'm trying to emphasize something. But I completely agree. Russell does have a certain flair for the dramatic, to put it mildly. And I love it when he leverages that towards setting the stage for the season, and the producers can use him for that, rather than when he gets the fifth confessional in a row talking about how great he himself is. That kind of self-aggrandizing just narcissism can get old after a while, but for this specific purpose, he is once again fantastic. And he and Rupert are the perfect contrast. You have the tie-dye pirate hero who is the hero of kids everywhere, and then just this avatar of pure evil who is going to just wreak havoc on the entire season yet again.
Yeah, and they do a really good job, I think, setting up the dichotomy between the heroes and the villains early on, where they very clearly deliberately alternate confessionals. I'll roll through the list here, where they go, JT gets a great heroic confessional, into Jerry getting a great villainous confessional about how she's the Black Widow, and Maneater Manthe. We get James leading into Coach, and then Tom Westman leading into Boston Rob's, what I'm going to say is a now iconic confessional that I think, Dom, we're going to be able to play audio clips for the people again this season. Let's play that clip for them right now.
These people are smart. They get rid of me right away. It's the smartest thing they could do. But they won't. They never do.
And I think this confessional is not only interesting just because of the way that this season will ultimately play out, where we'll go on to see this doesn't end up breaking his way and they do get rid of him relatively early, but it's also interesting if we factor in even more history and context to that, where it's been discussed, and I totally agree with it, that Boston Rob going out early here may actually have been the single best thing he could have asked for from this season, given that he would get a fourth opportunity. Because I think he was one of such one person, and I think there have been many of them, where after their first really impressive run, they're going to need to come back and take a hard loss before anyone's going to be willing to give them another chance. And if future season.
I agree with that, but I don't know if Rob is actually the best example here, because a lot of people were picking him after these first few episodes, and this might just be them buying into that that hero edit and extending that to the game as a whole. But there are people saying Boston Rob is at the top of our power rankings right now. It seems like he's in a great spot. He's at the head of this alliance. He does seem to have turned over a new leaf, at least in the minds of people who he will need to keep thinking that way for just long enough that he can slit their throats before the end.
I mean, how many tribes has Boston Rob been on where he has been able to overcome more than like one thinking person who was not willing to just follow his orders?
Well, I am not a Boston Rob. I don't have to.
How has no one come up with that? That's fantastic. Sorry.
So I don't have to answer for him personally here, but you look back to Marquesas, I guess that entire tribe was not really thinking at that point, and maybe he wasn't thinking either with that hunter move. And then in All Stars, he just gets to execute Rob Cesternino, basically, and then from there, he can just mow down the opposition. And then this time around, this is truly an all-star cast. And say what you want about the Daniels of the world and coach, at least at this stage, but there are some seriously capable players here, and many of those are in his alliance. Like, if Rob wants to make a run towards the end, not only does he have to beat out the heroes, who maybe are less capable pound for pound, but within his own group, you have Sandra, you have Tyson. This is not an easy path to the end, and if he goes in assuming that his old bag of tricks is just going to work effectively and flawlessly again this time, then he will have another thing coming. And it might be,
which I think he did assume and did have another thing coming, because he finally wasn't up against total sheep.
Yeah, and it might be the best outcome for him, again, given he gets to come back for a fourth time, that he goes out the way he did, where it's not even his mistake that dooms him, it's Tyson. I think if Rob somehow gets taken out in that tribe instead, maybe the reputation is different, but it's Tyson goes out, he gets to write that off as Tyson's blunder, which is now dragging all of them down with him, and then he makes his pitch to coach chickens out, he's a little man, and then he goes out looking like the underdog and the victim, when that is the last role that Boston Rob ever would want himself to be in or would ever identify with.
Yeah, I mean, to me, despite this being the season of positivity, Boston Rob is someone whose approach to the game I've always taken a sizable issue with. I mean, maybe not always, but certainly I feel like he is someone whose approach, despite constantly preaching adaptability and being flexible with all personality types, as far as I've ever been able to tell, it seems like Rob always goes out there with the exact same game plan. And as we'll go on to see during, I think it's episode 2, where he talks about how much of an effort he was putting into not being a dictator. And he makes it like to day 3 before he says, fuck it, I cannot go on without being the dictator. Enough is enough. I need to get this tribe into shape.
Yeah, we say that Boston Rob can't play like Natalie White, Natalie White can't play like Boston Rob, and you see proof of that right here. And Russell, in fact, came into the season trying to learn from Samoa, as he tells it. He said, having seen how effective Natalie's approach was in those early days of getting people to underestimate them, he tried to play like Natalie, and he very quickly learned that not only is that harder to do than it appears, but he specifically, it's impossible. There is no... you could... give him $1 million for just sitting on his hands until day 18, and he would not be able to do it. And this clash of the titans that we get between Rob and Russell, it's so inevitable. It's just the worst kind of like machismo fueled chest beating, and you know it's coming. And it's like watching this car crash in slow motion and not being able to do anything about it.
It's so funny watching this premiere where Boston Rob is talking about how he's going to try to stay laid back or more laid back than he normally is on Survivor. And I'm, you know, Amba, I'm trying. And Russell's talking about how starstruck he is to be around such legends of the game. And then by episode 2, Boston Rob is yelling at everyone to do things his way. And Russell is talking about how much better he is. And no way, he's the Michael Phelps of Survivor. And some people are just above the game like him. None of this lasting very long, but it's really interesting to see them going out there at least trying to have some kind of like learning, to have learned something from their earlier mistakes.
Yeah, I don't know if I would credit Russell with that much self-doubt or willingness to learn or introspection to any degree, but again, season of positivity, we're trying to find the best in people here.
I think it was the season of positivity for Russell too. He was trying to give his opponents credit for as long as he could.
And it worked great. So moving on down the sequence here, we have Colby, who says, I'm almost a decade older than I was last time, so to me this is a test to see if I've still got it.
So I don't know how much we're going to get into this today, because Colby is not one of the more prominent players over the first like 20 minutes of this episode, but Colby, during these early episodes that I've been rewatching, is the person who, for me, at least to this point, I am loving way more than I expected to. He is, this happened the same sort of thing happened when I would watch seasons of The Genius for like the third time. There would be people who didn't even stand out the first time I had rewatched it. But now that I really have fully absorbed all of the main stuff and can focus more on the character notes and the background, Colby is the person who, during these early episodes, is really jumping out to me as way more fun than I remembered. So I'm definitely going to stay in line with the season of positivity to this point and say Colby, at least to the point that I have rewatched so far, is fantastic, and I'm thrilled to have him back.
Certainly. I know in real time people were trashing Colby for being so pathetic and so underwhelming, and he really did flop compared to his other two times. But I think that's because you come in with these expectations. As James articulated, Colby was his hero, and now he comes back and discovers that his Superman sucks. But when you go in without those expectations and you know what Colby's eventual fate is, you learn to appreciate him that much more, and his character definitely improves on a rewatch for me. So for that question of whether he still got it, he used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what he's with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to him, I think is the way to put it. He says himself he's coming into a completely different game, and he has a great secret scene where he says that, like, not only is this different by virtue of being an All-Star season, but just the pace of the game has accelerated so rapidly that you just get left behind if you're not immediately hitting the ground running. And he found that himself, and he ended up almost like Aubrey on Game Changers, I would say, where it's like he's just there as an observer, and it's unclear how much fun he's ever really having. And he makes it far, and you start to think, if you're a Colby fan towards the end, maybe, just maybe, there's an outside shot, but you know it's so unlikely to come to pass, and that when he does eventually go out, you will be disappointed, he'll be disappointed, but you won't be surprised.
Right, it's a really interesting situation for Colby, where I would probably say that part of the reason he makes it so far into the end of the game is, despite everyone remembering Colby from Australia and him being one of the most, like, iconic players in the history of the franchise when his popularity was at its peak, I would probably say that Colby was left around for so long, largely because he was not viewed as too big of a threat within the actual, like, political, social spectrum of the game. And it's so funny watching Colby when they finally get to Heroes Camp. I think it's Candace that he's talking to, whoever it is that he's talking to, wondering literally who some of the people on his tribe are. He doesn't know not only who's friendly with whom, he's never even heard a Ray. When he shows up on the Heroes mat, these may as well be people that he just ran into in the grocery store, as far as he's concerned. But it is, like, we hear Colby talk about it and put it in explicit terms of, I'm back out here to see if I still got it, in this opening confessional. I think this really was for him not something that he went into thinking, I'm going to go in there and play the game hard as hell. I think he was literally potentially more interested in, like, can I still be a challenge beast, and can I still make fire and provide around camp and be viewed as an asset?
You could make the case, and if I feel so inclined, I might well make the case later on, that Colby came closer to winning Survivor in this season than he ever did before, including in Australia, because you can say, if he just writes a different name down on that parchment, he's a millionaire, he gains $900,000, and the entire course of Survivor lore and canon after that point changes. But I think based on the values that he was playing that game with at the time, he was always voting Keith out there and taking Tina. Whereas here, he has no agency in the game. There's no control over his own fate. But if he can summon up something that, you know, some of that energy and power that he lost 10 years ago, and just bink those final two challenges, he wins the game. And it would be amazing if he just backdoored his way into the finals, into winning this epic blowout All-Star season, despite never winning a single challenge. That would be the perfect... there would be many perfect endings to this season for me, but that would be up there for sure.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. So I'm really, really excited to track Colby because, as I mentioned, watching these early episodes back again, he has been so much fun for me. And he has so many great moments over the course of the season as well, with the reward challenge, with the popcorn idol clue. Of course, Reed coming out for the loved ones challenge. So I'm really looking forward to noting all of the fun Colby moments. And I would say from this early, for the early stretch, my favorite thing about Colby is the way that I still think he's the only one that I've at least ever noticed doing this. He somehow ties his buff into, like, a neckerchief, like a Boy Scout, and it's so on brand. It's perfect to have Colby rocking that kind of style. So speaking of on brand, we get our first introduction this season to Sandra, and what a fantastic confessional from Sandra we end up getting here.
Last time I was mean, and this time I'm meaner. You know, I'll lie, I don't care, but I'll make up a good lie.
So season of positivity indeed for Sandra here as well. And I'm going to say in earnest, in terms of the season of positivity, while there will probably be some spots, I don't know, from time to time where we may take, may have some counterpoints to the ideas that Sandra ended up coming up with, I really do want to say this premiere is a fantastic Sandra episode.
Yeah, Sandra, and it almost has to be a good Sandra episode because there will be no more Sandra episodes for the next month and a half or so. So you have to get your Sandra fix in now. But definitely a great opening quote, one which we're going to add to the soundboard or the Sandra board if you prefer. But we will make use of these clips quite liberally, I think, although we have to be responsible because no one has ever used a soundboard sparingly in their lives. There should be some kind of licensing procedure for soundboards, I think, just to make sure that they don't get into the wrong hands. You know, we'll try to be mature about it and keep it to where it's truly necessary.
Yeah, all right. So there is Sandra. She's back on the Villains Tribe. And we get the 39 days, 20 people, one survivor. As the choppers fly over Probst and as I mentioned, the water comes crashing in behind him, cue the full intro. What an incredible opening sequence here. And frankly, I know, let's dive into some classic Colin Stone hyperbole right away. I don't see how any intro for any season ever tops this until we get an actual this caliber all-star cast again, because while there are potentially more beautiful locations or more electric kind of voiceovers that Jeff Probst will give in later seasons, this to me, this just the sheer ridiculousness of this cast is something that no other season introduction could ever contend with, just the sheer star power here. I truly don't feel like I've ever been this excited or even close from an introduction to a Survivor season.
It's that combination of the setup and the environment and having those military helicopters that they loan from the New Zealand Air Force combined with having this amazing roster of returning players. You need both to make this as amazing as it was, and just having one or the other, it would be fun, I'm sure, and there's a lot you could do with it, but having the two in concert makes for just this truly electric opening to the season. You said before that Jeff seemed a little bit more low-key, and he's just standing on the rocks this time. He's not hanging out of a chopper. He's not doing anything precarious for himself, but that shot of him fading out and then seeing the helicopters and hearing those fly overhead, then it immediately drops into the intro. That's when I knew, okay, I'm watching something truly special here.
Yeah. And I like credit where it's due to the season 31 cast, which I think is tremendously solid from top to bottom, and them walking through like the Angkor temples was really cool. And there have been many other seasons where the introduction sequence has been totally fantastic as well. But I really just don't think there's anything any season can do, conceivably, to compete with the idea of here's a chopper with Suri and Tom Westman and JT on it, and we cut to the next chopper, and it's Russell and Parvati and Coach and Boston Rob. But like, there's just nothing you can do without a cast of that caliber to get the excitement that high.
So we return to those helicopters to get these final shots as they start their descent, and everybody else is adhering to the fourth wall. They don't seem to see it there. They're just staring off into the distance. Presumably some of them just drinking in this amazing introduction that they're getting to be a part of. And Coach breaks from all of that to just like do this Tai Chi pose directly to the camera, showing this awareness of the situation that he's in. And that will be the first of many, many great Coach moments in this season.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to be no shortage of Coach moments over the course.
And he sets a tone for what's to come here, because one thing you notice with Coach on a rewatch is he can never fit into the crowd. He always has to one-up anybody that he's talking to. So let's play the clip here.
Flying in on the helicopters, you can feel something in the air. There's an electricity. There's a tension. There's a level of excitement that is coursing through everybody's veins, especially mine. And to start off like that, I think sets a great tone for how the season is going to be.
And that sets a great tone for how Coach is going to be all season as well. And this season is so much better for having Coach in it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can't wait to dive into. Coach has got to be very near the top of the list for as long as he's on this season or any season that he's on.
Here's my hot take on that. So Coach has evolved a lot as a character over the course of his 3-season arc. And I think Heroes vs. Villains traditionally isn't really remembered as a big part of that. It's this 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 lull in the middle between Token Change, which introduced the Coach Wade experience to the world, and South Pacific, where he becomes a new man, or he tries to be Boston Rob, he tries to be Tyson, and ends up going down in this like religious hypocrisy fueled blaze of glory or infamy. And this season is just lost in between. But I think this is my favorite Coach season. I think when you go back and you look for Coach, and you don't have to do much looking, he readily presents himself to you. I think there is more just gold. This season is a true gold mine for Coach in a way that the other seasons are as well, but not even to the same level.
Right. The first time around, we didn't really know what to expect, and I think Coach didn't really know what to expect in terms of how he was going to be presented on the TV show. And the third time around, I would say he was too aware of how he was going to be presented on the TV show, and also just cared finally about winning the game. But I do think you're onto something, Dom, that this is the perfect kind of awareness level for Coach to be delivering on TV to give us all that we want out of Coach Wade.
So all of the contestants here, it's truly an ensemble cast in terms of driving the excitement. They all talk about how they're playing an even bigger game this time, and they're ready to come back and compete. And Coach, as one might expect, steals the line of the episode. He gets to have that title quote saying, "This time I slay everyone and trust no one," which is so amazing. And then we get to Amanda, who introduces herself this way.
I'm nervous and I'm excited. You know, like, before you bungee jump or something, you get that knot in your stomach, and it, like, makes you want to throw up, kind of. That's how I feel right now.
It's really in keeping with her brand that everyone else is so excited to be there, and Amanda just wants to throw up. And it's great because you have this... this great scoring as well, that the music really helps to make this scene what it is. And for everybody else, that's in keeping with what they're saying. They're trying to generate hype and so is the music. And it feels so discordant when the same music is there and it's just Amanda speaking slowly and monotonously about how just miserable she is and how unexcited she is at this entire prospect. And you can take that music and put it underneath anything and immediately just have like this swell. It just adds a sensation to it, and I'm sure we will experiment with that over the course of this episode.
All right, well, we'll see what we can do as far as the musical cues go. But yeah, a lot of fun getting everyone's favorite Amanda back on the screen as well. And as the choppers land, the heroes get onto the beach first. I quickly wanted to note, there's such a cool shot from, it's like pilot's eye view of the villain's helicopter as Probst and all the heroes are standing on the beach waiting for those choppers to land. And it's really cool to see it from their perspective, coming down on, like descending onto the beach. And as the villains all get out and Boston Rob has his swagger as he's walking over to the beach, as Courtney Yates points out, so cool to see everyone lined up there, have Jeff introducing everyone and get down to the mat chat and get into really introducing the season and finally start hearing these people really interact with each other and really get the game underway.
And it's great timing as well, because you have the heroes getting in there first, their chopper lands, they get out on the mat, and then as the villain's chopper descends, it blows up all this sand into their faces. So already you have the animosity that you'd expect, and then the villains get to make their dramatic entrance, like WWE style, to this music, whereas if you did it in reverse, and it's just the heroes politely landing at a safe distance and then slowly disembarking from their helicopter, it wouldn't have quite the same effect.
Right, yeah, you got to have the villains like blazing this wildfire path through where the heroes were already set up, as the heroes all like grabbed for their hats as the wind is blowing them off their head from the chopper landing right next to them. It's a lot of fun.
And speaking of which, excellent hat game this season, by the way. So not only did you have Jerry in her black hat versus Colby in his white hat, you have the infamous B hat for Boston Rob. You have Russell's hat that ends up getting burned by Sandra later on in the season. Really a great hat game. That's the big thing missing from Modern Survivor. It's not the intro. It's not anything else.
Sandra's got a great like Fidel Castro hat too that she wears this whole season.
And that's what stands out to me about Survivor South Africa. It's just hats everywhere. They haven't learned to have a more restrictive wardrobe yet. And I really hope they never do, because it adds a lot for me.
Yeah, this is absolutely not Colin Stone hyperbole. The Survivor South Africa, whatever, I think it's season 6 that is currently airing, the only season that I've watched, the hats on that season are easily the greatest season of hats Survivor has ever seen. There are so many incredible hats on that show. So we all get to the mats, and Jeff starts talking to the group, and he's, at least on TV, the first person we see him talk to is Russell, who talks about how happy he is to be included on the season and how proud he is to be considered one of the 10 best villains of all time. We then go over to Boston Rob, who doesn't quite understand why he's a villain, which I thought was a fantastic answer and is so perfect for Boston Rob. And I think this is the kind of thing, as many faults as I may find with his like approach to the strategic game, I think he is a master of that kind of these really like small social things. Like, yes, he's acknowledging, of course I'm a villain, but he's doing it in a way that's almost like disarming and making people like him.
By contrast, Russell, after being asked how it feels to be deemed one of the most notorious villains of all time, you might think coming into the season as this unknown quantity who is trying to avoid suspicion, you would lean away from that, but instead he embraces it and he rises to the challenge and almost issues that challenge to the other players at the same time.
I think what people know or should have thought about Russell is something we should save for next time. I think that would very much slow us down this week, but is definitely an interesting conversation to have. But you're totally right that I would have thought Russell would be doing every single thing he could to just try to blend in and be as unthreatening as possible. But as we'll get into. Go ahead.
And by next week, you mean last week when we spoke about this on the first podcast in this series. So if you're a patron, you've already heard that. If you're not, what are you doing with yourself? Sign up now and get the inside scoop.
Sorry, we talked about it a little bit, but I think there is more to get into there. You're right, we definitely did address that issue, but I think as we start actually seeing it play out and see the approach Russell takes, that will definitely come back up.
So Jeff meanwhile is setting the stage for this, giving these brief introductory taglines, if you like, for some of these contestants, because these are all-stars and these are very memorable players. But, you know, if someone played 10 years ago for the first time, maybe your memory has faded a bit. So it's nice that he's just jogging your memory a little bit. And as part of this, Jeff asks all of the contestants who thinks they're on the wrong tribe. And as you might expect, half the villains instantly raise their hand. None of the heroes do. One of those villains is Parvati, and he immediately rebukes her with this very emphatic statement about Parvati being a villain, which, in light of the rumors that we discussed last time of maybe this last-minute switch taking place where Parvati was meant to be on the hero's tribe, Candace is meant to be a villain, it is interesting that he would just go at her like that so hard when, if one thing had gone differently in casting, maybe he'd be struggling to find something to say to Candace there instead.
Right, it's so funny where he sets up all the heroes. He talks to like Rupert and Tom and Colby about how heroic and popular they were. And then he goes over to Parvati and he's like, now here we are with Parvati, one of the most diabolical players in the show's history. And like doesn't even give her a chance to speak and defend herself. He just like sets up for the entire cast why none of them should trust Parvati. And then goes over to James to say, James, where do you think Parvati should be? And James is like, oh, definitely a villain. She's one of the talkers. The talkers are the most dangerous people. It really was fascinating. And I'm sure in the moment, Parvati did have plenty of back and forth with Jeff. But just to see it presented on the show that way of Probst truly just laying out why no one should trust her at all. And actually, one other thing before we move on from the Matt chat and things of that nature, I wanted to get to one thing that he mentioned to Colby, which is, Colby, you were so popular, people were naming their children after you. And I wanted to get an official bet on the record here, Dom. I've set the line for what season it will be that we end up seeing someone on the CBS version of Survivor named Colby, who was at least allegedly named after Colby as Australia was airing. Will this happen before or after season 42 and a half? So 42 is the earlier or 43 is the later.
I'm going to take the under on that. Wasn't it, I think it was Cass who named something or other after Colby. And if Cass named one of her children after Colby, you instantly put that person on the show. Like to have that storyline there, as well as just good genes in Survivor TV terms, that's a no-brainer for me.
I believe also Dr. Mike named his son Ethan after Ethan Zahn, or someone is named after Ethan Zahn in Mike Zahowski's family.
Sure.
Yeah, and Ethan, I'm extending this to Colby or Ethan. I will count either of those. If they get a Colby or an Ethan, someone who is named after one of the immensely popular characters, I truly think, assuming Survivor stays on the air, that is not a matter of if, but a matter of when. So
now I'm looking forward to someone just getting named after some hopelessly obscure survivor from the early seasons. Like, my parents just really love Jesse Camacho, and that's how I ended up here. So
that is a deep cut by you, Dom. The Jesse Camacho pull is a nice one. Yeah, I think it'd be fun if we had like a whole season of this person was named after Colby, and this person was named after Richard Hatch, and this person was named after Boston Rob, and now we're gonna run back All Stars, the next generation.
Yeah, so Vesepia, what's your backstory? Well, Jeff, as it turns out.
Yeah. All right. One other final note that I had as they were standing there before the first challenge begins. Jeff asked Boston Rob what he thinks about the way the tribes are divided and the way the teams match up. And he says, I think we have a huge advantage over them. Our women are stronger and our guys can hang with their guys. I love you, Colby. But man, did you get the raw end of the deal here. And Jeff says, so no one intimidates you? And Rob says, I didn't say that. I just think we're going to have the advantage not having to deal with all the egos over there. End quote, which is so funny given that villains tribe, as soon as they hit the camp, is essentially going to fracture into people willing to be bossed around by Boston Rob and people not. Boston Rob, is that a better nickname for him? Thank you. I can't believe, much like Boss Stan Rob, I can't believe it took that long to come up with that.
And it's truly mind-blowing that Boston Rob somehow isn't the biggest ego on that tribe, that there are others, at least three or four other people, solidly in contention for that spot.
Right, I think you've got at least Coach Tyson and Russell all above him, at the very least.
You can make a case for Sandra too, but let's not, again, season of positivity, we don't need to go there.
That's right. Sandra not on day one, probably Sandra on day 39 might have been a different story. All right, there we go, Dom. There are our two tribes. They have hit the beach, and before we even get to camp...
Well, let's actually get into whether you think what Rob said there has any substance, because you look at how these tribes are divided up. The story of the season basically is the heroes just get annihilated constantly in the first three or four weeks, and then as soon as Russell turns the tables on Rob and you vote out Tyson and then Rob, their fortunes just continue to slide and they have to go back to two more tribals after that, vote out Cody and Courtney. So what do you make of the way these tribes were divided? Like, if so, do you see this as being one of those dominant tribe situations where if they don't vote out their two strongest guys for other reasons, is this just continued annihilation? Like, are we going to see the heroes getting wiped out pre-merge?
That's certainly a possibility that I'd actually never even really put much thought into. Is I did think Boston Rob was actually being overconfident in the moment, like in just looking across the mat at particularly the five guys on the Heroes tribe, all truly seem like total beasts compared to, like, Russell's strong, but Russell is not a large man, and I didn't think of Coach as like a big physical asset, and certainly not Randy Bailey. My money certainly would have been on the Heroes tribe to be the challenge favorites, but you're right, particularly when Boston Rob was part of the equation, the villains more often than not did a lot of just curb stomping in most of the challenges. So I think you could definitely be onto something, particularly with the understanding that Boston Rob is going to be the person essentially controlling that group of people. I don't know what anyone has ever seen out of Boston Rob that would lead them to believe it wouldn't be eventually like an Ometepe situation before Ometepe even existed.
And also when he says our women are stronger than their women, that's coming shortly before they have to jump through hoops every single week to like alternate sitting out Sandra and Courtney at the right time so that they don't get sabotaged in the challenge. And you look over at the Heroes tribe, I guess Ceree might be a liability in some cases, but by and large, like, you have Amanda, who is a physical threat among all of her seasons, Candace, who's good in the challenges, Stephanie, and I guess Sugar's not there long enough to really count. So on that front, it seems like the Heroes have them beat too. So I don't know where Rob was really getting that from, but I guess his confidence proved to be well-founded, at least while he was there.
Well, if you're going to be the team captain, you might as well get your team motivated right away, right? Who's going to follow the guy who doesn't believe in us?
Yeah, that's right. And my usual assumption is it's more about who's dragging your team down. Like, who you can only go at the pace of your slowest member, rather than having these all-stars just carry you by themselves in one or two challenges. If you're being weighed down by a Sandra or a Courtney, that's a much greater liability than having the whatever the delta is between Boston Rob and JT, let's say.
Yeah, and there's a scene, I think it's when they go and vote out I think it's when they go and vote out Stephanie. One of the arguments that they make is we need to vote out a girl. So they stop sit, or it's the opposite. It's whatever happens, it because one tribe is voting out someone else to make it so that both Sandra and Courtney can't sit out of the challenges together, that one of them has to be in there to make to kind of weigh the villains down a little bit.
And that's one of the arguments that you see when it does come down to a coach versus Courtney, of like, if we keep Sandra and Courtney, we're going to be in the spot again. And if we want to avoid that, if there's no strategic benefit to being there, then that has to be at the forefront of your mind.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's move over to our first challenge of the season here now, Dom. Before they even get to go to camp, they're going to play a reward challenge. This is the one where I think I mentioned it earlier, but if not, they're wrestling in the sand for these bags that are buried underground in 2-on-2 matchups. And I think this challenge, we'll go on to see. And we'll get into, there are several injuries, some of varying degrees of seriousness, that I think are going to go on to have not only an impact on the way this season plays out with some of the injuries that nag people for the next however many days they make it, but also it's going to have an impact, I think, on just the future of Survivor challenges. I can't think of many mega physical challenges that we end up seeing after Heroes versus Villains. To me, like, I would say this challenge, Schnurgen Brawl from Guatemala, where they're recreating like the game that they used to play, that were like the Aztecs or the Mayans or whatever it was. Mayans, the Empire in Guatemala. They used to like throw people's severed heads through hoops, and they made that into like a super physical challenge that people ended up getting totally brutalized on. Or the one that you're talking about, Dom, not bocce ball, but when there are several people are down in the pit, the one that's going to end up really injuring James later on in this season, that was a big issue. Or Fans versus Favorites, the one where they're running through all the traps and Joel is like dragging Chet behind him. I understand why they want to ramp up the physicality and the excitement, but hot, totally predictable Colin Stone take here, I am not down with this at all. I think if we are running that serious of an injury risk in any of these challenges, I think that's too far. I think any challenge that someone could has a realistic chance of even dislocating a toe, as we saw with Rupert, is too much for me.
That might be one of your coldest takes of all time, but I am totally on board with it too.
All right, thank you. I'm glad we're off to the season of positivity that we were always going for.
There has to be a way to get these visually exciting challenges, which do seem to be in short supply nowadays, while also insulating the contestants from that level of physical danger.
Right, yeah. So we'll end up seeing right away in this opening round, it's Parvati and Danielle against Stephanie and Sari. And as soon as the round ends, Stephanie's got a dislocated shoulder. Dr. Ramona's on the scene trying to pop it back in place. And it's very clear right off the bat that this is going to be a very intense, almost violent kind of season. And it's actually a pretty fitting start to the season, having this be the beginning of the first challenge.
And Dalton Ross, I think it was last year, tweeted out some of the lost footage that he was trawling through his archives and was able to unearth from being on location in Heroes vs. Villains. So from that, you get the Natalie Bolton pre-game press shots. But one of the things you get there is Stephanie actually dislocating that shoulder in real time. So it is weird to watch that clip without the sound there, just like setting the tempo for what's going on. And you see the looks of concern on everyone's faces. You see Jeff not appreciating the gravity of the situation at first, and then just calling for medical, and they hurry in and get to her. But apparently, you see Courtney say, like, oh, break her shoulder. Apparently that was after this had already happened. So that's Courtney just adding even more fuel to the fire there. and yeah, establishing her status as a villain, for sure. And in case you didn't appreciate yourself how serious it was at the time, luckily we have Candace on deck to explain it for us.
I'm a medical student, and when I saw Stephanie dislocate her shoulder, I knew she could leave the game permanently over something like that.
Now, I'm no medical student. I'm a lowly philosophy major. But even I can tell that the dislocating your shoulder might impede your ability to compete in future challenges. So stay tuned on that front, potentially.
Yeah. So with Stephanie's shoulder out of its socket, the villains are going to score that first point. JT is going to even it up for the heroes in the second round. And then round three is what I'm going to again use the word iconic. I think most people who have seen Heroes versus Villains at least a couple of times will remember Coach frog marching Colby to the villain's mat, whatever the hell frog marching is. I've never understood what that means, although I feel like I have a pretty good idea just based on the visual of it. And then that, of course, is met with this fantastic confessional from Tyson that gets spliced in over the challenge. It's recorded back at camp, but it was so strong, they even go out of their way to include it as the challenge is taking place. Let's take a listen.
Colby getting owned by Coach? Oh my gosh, dude. I can only imagine what Colby's thinking. He's got to be like, I may as well just become a woman because there's no point on trying to maintain my masculinity now.
And I will acknowledge, this may not be the most woke confessional in the year 2018, but I really do want to go back to it. I feel like you've got to be doing something right in the confessional department at the point that Survivor was at during Heroes versus Villains, if they are taking your regular camp confessionals and splicing them in over the challenge. And I feel like this is something we've actually seen a little more in recent seasons. I want to say, like, Sarah Lacina got some commentary spliced in over one of the challenges, and this is something I think they're more comfortable with, but I feel like it was pretty rare for a long time.
A lot of the time that's nowadays related to there's some twist at the challenge, there's an advantage, or there's some other thing going on that you need to explain to the audience, whereas this is just Tyson roasting someone for how badly they got owned, and that's more in tune with what we want, I think.
Right, yeah, I think you are right about Sarah talking about the advantage, or people I think we'll get commentary spliced in if they're the person who's looking for an idol at the challenge or something like that, where it's really necessary to help narrate what's going on at a challenge. But this is just Tyson roasting Coach. And there's actually a fantastic scene later on once they get to the villains camp where Coach gives this like faux humble kind of confessional about how amazed everyone was with his performance. You know, I'd already long forgotten about it. I guess we could play the full clip. Let's play the full clip.
In case Coach has long since forgotten about it. In case you have too, let's roll the tape.
Everybody thought that Colby was going to have his way with me. The tribe was talking about it long after I'd forgotten it, about how I'd gone out there and basically frog marched Colby to the mat at the end. So it was very fulfilling.
So yeah, a fantastic Coach moment there. And then we get back, Courtney and Sandra are facing Candace and Sugar in the next round. And Dom, season of positivity staying thematic here. Sandra with her first iconic moment of the season where she unhooks Sugar's top to try to think that's going to keep her from running away. Turns out Sugar doesn't mind so much. She grabs the bag, runs to the hero's mat topless, and then flips the double bird to Sandra after scoring the point, which I don't know how many times this has happened in Survivor history. We have the rare triple blur here from the censors between each of Sugar's middle fingers and also her boobs being totally wide open.
Is that a quadruple blur, or are we straddling the line there? I'm not sure, but either way, Amanda Kimmel is shook. This is the first and the last triple blur that we'll ever see, so at least Sugar secured her place in history.
Yeah, and maybe something that should have been blurred that I truly never get tired of is the next round where Tyson and Boston Rob are taking on James and Rupert, and right before he's getting ready to run out onto the sand, Tyson strips down to his little leopard print short shorts. I die laughing at that every single time. I think that's so great.
It's so good. Tyson's wardrobe by itself could be the focus of an entire like Patreon rewatch series. It's truly an endless well of entertainment.
Yeah, and so this is going to actually, at least in the TV version, be the deciding point here when James ends up winning this for the heroes. And I know we've commented many times in the past that James, it's weird almost to see him constantly, at least in China, be like the first person picked in all of the challenge drafts. When, yes, he is a behemoth, but frankly, there aren't a ton of Survivor challenges where that's going to matter too much. This is one of those challenges where it matters a great deal, and anyone who has James on their side is going to be in fantastic shape, and anyone who does not have James on their side, if they're going out there facing James, there's virtually no point even trying in a challenge like this. Like, you're not going to get through him, and you're certainly not going to stop him if he's the one who gets the bag.
Yeah, it's no coincidence, I think, that Courtney ends up in China with more immunity wins than James does. But you look at that challenge that she won there. That's like the only type of challenge that she could win. And for that challenge, only Courtney could win it. You know, basically, as soon as that challenge is set up, what the outcome's going to be. And I feel like the same is true on the far distant opposite end of the spectrum here with James and these physical challenges. This is the only type of thing that he's good at, but he is unbeatable in a challenge like this.
Right, the same. I think it's episode 3 where they have the mud brawl challenge where they're beating each other with pillows, and that's another one where the villains know, okay, we're just going to save Randy to go up whenever James goes up, because whoever we put in is going to get their fucking ass kicked, so we might as well have it be Randy.
He can be our sacrificial lamb, and in case James just kills Randy or just delivers grievous bodily harm with that challenge, we're going to vote him out anyway, so it's no great loss.
So James is going to win it for the heroes there, and this is also the run, incidentally, where Rupert breaks his toe, but Rupert is a total hero, as is Dr. Ramona, so they're both going to be able to get him through that, although it is going to be probably a factor for him the rest of the season, as we're going to see. He spends the rest of the time basically just bandaged up and complaining about his toe, but there you go with the sand wrestling challenge. And I really do think that, again, to it, this like really intense, borderline like vicious and violent kind of challenge is a really fitting kind of icebreaker for this season, as everyone's about to head to camp and start politically doing exactly that same kind of thing to each other.
Yeah, it sets the stage for what's to come so well. And I imagine out there in real time on, I don't know, hour two or three of day one, the producers must feel like they were knocking it out of the park. They must have been so happy with everything that's transpired up until this point, other than Rupert potentially getting medevaced down the line. So we want to avoid that if at all possible.
Yeah, all right. Well, Dom, I think that will wrap up the actual Survivor coverage from this week. It seems like we're making pretty good time, although we do want to get to a recurring segment that the non-patrons will not be too familiar with, but the regular patrons will certainly know and hopefully love. It is our examination of the shows that CBS is constantly popping up on the bottom of the screen to try to get you to watch in different time slots. That's right. It's time for the first edition on Survivor versus Heroes versus Villains of Coming This Fall. And Dom, coming this fall on CBS, although not actually coming this fall because it debuted 4 days prior to the Heroes versus Villains premiere in February 2010, Undercover Boss. This is based on a British TV series where the CEO of whatever company somehow gets disguised in like a wig and I would imagine a fake mustache most often, and goes undercover within the company to see how it kind of operates at the lower levels. I do not understand how this actually works. I've never seen an episode, but it's based on a British show. Have you ever seen this, or do you know how this works at all?
I have. I've seen the British version, I've seen the American version, and what do you think of this concept, first of all?
So it seems like an interesting concept for like a once every so often kind of TV special, but I would have thought it would be, certainly once it enters like the mainstream awareness, it's always baffled me that they're able to get away with this. Like, I'm very curious what the lie is that they tell the people who are suddenly being filmed constantly now that this new employee has shown up.
So apparently what they do is 5 or 6 months prior, they have the employees fill out a questionnaire under some other like auspices, I think is the word, whatever it is. They get them to just divulge all of these personal details. And then whoever has the most TV friendly story or whoever seemed like they just are naturally photogenic, they get plucked out later on for this experiment, if you like, where they will work alongside the undercover boss who, again, this is like a kids spy cartoon level disguise. It is really just not convincing whatsoever. And you think they will be rumbled instantly. And it turns out in at least half the cases, it's all set up anyway. Everyone knows who everyone else is, and they're just playing along for the cameras and maybe have a good future in acting somewhere down the line. But the undercover boss goes and works alongside them for a bit, and then eventually this all builds towards this tale of woe where whoever they're working with breaks down seemingly spontaneously, tells them about this deep struggle that they're going on, that's going on in their life, which isn't helped by the fact that they're working in these awful conditions and so on and so forth. And this benevolent oligarch springs out of this disguise to rescue them from all their worldly troubles.
Yeah, I haven't seen the actual show, but I have seen the SNL parody from the episode that Adam Driver hosted where Kylo Ren from Star Yes. Wars was the undercover boss. And then also Key and Peele did an amazing parody of it as well, where Keegan-Michael Key was the like delinquent employee who spent the whole time like trashing the boss. And then when he found out it was the undercover boss, he was like all quick to change his tune and try to get free stuff. It's very, very good. I think when I was trying to think of the like how they got the people on board to make this happen. It does, its story does majorly check out that it turns out most of the people who are allegedly being like misted by this undercover boss were probably aware of what was going on most of the time. But it reminded me of one of my favorite kind of things that I've just heard along similar lines. I'm a huge fan of Sacha Baron Cohen, and Ali G is my favorite of his characters. And I remember reading years and years ago, after wondering, how the hell does he get people to agree to do these interviews with him? He's doing interviews with like world famous people. And the way that they ended up doing that is the Ali G character would walk in alongside a guy in like a suit and a tie who looked really professional. And they would tell the person, okay, this random weirdo is going to interview you, just to get you like check the sound levels and get you mic'd up and make sure everything's looking all right. And the people would just assume that later on the guy in the suit would come in and talk to them, and then they would they would get blindsided by just being an interview with Ali G. And I thought that was very much in line with this, and that's always one of my favorite kind of Hollywood backstories explaining how they actually got all those people to do it that I loved. So Dom, as I've mentioned, I've never seen an episode of this, but I've heard good things about it. I saw on the Wikipedia page that it was almost every year nominated for Outstanding Reality TV Series for the Emmys, and it actually won the Emmy in 2012 and 2013. It has been on the air since, as I mentioned, February 2010. It is still ongoing in America, and this show is crushing the Gary Unmarried line of 37 episodes. So far, 111 episodes of Undercover Boss have aired, despite the fact that, it's, as far as I can tell, it seems like it's exactly the same thing every single time.
It serves a valuable purpose, because it's like this running indictment of everything that's wrong with whatever society is able to be aired in. Because if you actually think about what this show implies, and the fact that this show can exist, what that implies too, it is a grotesque nightmare of a show. This should not even be possible. So first of all, like, it promotes this idea that the only barrier between the average employee and their boss that's earning 350 times what they're earning is ignorance. And as soon as the scales drop from their eyes, as soon as they walk a mile in their shoes, they're going to turn over a new leaf and reform their company, and we're going to enter this new age of coexisting in harmony. When in reality, like, a lot of these bosses, they know, at least on some level, what's going on in their company, and if they don't, they can find out pretty easily, and they just have no incentive to change, so why would they? Like, nothing comes to them from getting anything out of this. And in fact, a lot of companies want to be on Undercover Boss because it offers them, firstly, just name recognition and free publicity, but it also gives whoever the boss ends up being the chance to portray themselves as this benefactor, that's giving this poor hapless employee the chance to have this new amazing life. But in reality, like, a lot of the time it's them being given just either the benefits or just the recognition as a human being that they should receive automatically anyway, and that the fact that they're bringing them up to where the bar should be should not, like, that shouldn't be a point in the company's favor or the employee's favor. Also, think about what needs to happen for you to end up as the person who gets rescued by the undercover boss. So if you're the lucky worker who gets chosen, firstly, you need to have this soundbite-friendly personal tale of tragedy. And so it can't be that your tragedy that you're undergoing is just enduring the drudgery of this terrible job under a fucking clueless boss for no money every single day. It needs to be that your granny is dying of cancer, and your husband's left home, and your two kids are sleeping under a bridge somewhere, and you need to outcompete everybody else in the bad luck Olympics in order to get chosen as this person. And then you need to perform that personal tragedy for your boss on national TV and cry at the right moments and break down in the right way and give the producers what they want. And in return, maybe you will get plucked out of the doldrums and get this new life. And to me, that's a gross and alien concept. That should really not be happening. Furthermore, I continue in this vein. This show is proof that you can have zero understanding of what's going on in the lives of your workers or just what their day-to-day life as your employee is like, and that doesn't stop you from getting to the top or staying there. And there's no personal repercussions for you or for your own job security. You can just stay there being blissfully ignorant, making these decisions which screw people over, and nothing's going to happen to you. And there's no reckoning that you have to face at any point. And it also explodes this idea that to be successful in business, makes you some kind of authority figure. That you must have made these intelligent decisions and taken these bold risks, and you're really worth listening to on that and on other subjects. Because how important can you really be to how your company's working if you can just vanish and be absent from running your company for that length of time? And also, you're just going around one of your plants or your stores and nobody has any fucking idea who you are. Like, if they don't recognize you, how important can you really be to what they do in their daily lives? Finally, to give an example of this, to give an example of how just messed up this show is. So there was one episode where the boss finds out that one of his employees, the employee that he's working with, is living in a homeless shelter. So the big reveal, the big finish to this episode is he promotes her. He gives her this gift, and she's now living this wonderful new life. Okay, great for her. Not taking anything away from that. What that means now, though, is that vacancy has to be filled by someone else who now will be earning so little money that they, too, might have to live in a homeless shelter or just be scrabbling to make ends meet. And you're never going to hear that story. You're never going to hear any of the other stories of any other employees working in this place. There's no structural reform. There's no nothing. It's just one person gets lifted out of this terrible situation, and that situation continues. And the person who gets to look like the hero coming out of it is the employer for not doing what they should be doing anyway and making sure that no one under their purview has to live in those circumstances.
I'm waiting for you to say "in conclusion" and go on to some
other thing. No, I'm good. I'm good. If you have any closing thoughts, I'd love to hear them.
Well, my closing thoughts are this, which is 90 minutes ago, we did not have a coming this fall planned. And then I remembered, oh, Undercover Boss popped up during the challenge. We can go into that. I looked on the Wikipedia. I didn't know Dom was going to even have that much to say about it. I really do feel like, Dom, in the 6.5 year history of this podcast, that right there must be by far the longest you have gone speaking uninterrupted. That was like several. I wouldn't shock me if you just doubled your personal record for longest monologue in the history of this podcast.
What does that say about the frequency of you interrupting me? Maybe that's the takeaway here.
I have no idea what you're talking about when it comes to that, but there is Undercover Boss, which is still...
In conclusion, I would happily watch a show if it's either... Like, the employees seize control of the company and the boss has to go undercover to escape, or you flip the premise around. It's a worker goes undercover as the boss, so now they're going to board meetings and glad handing at fundraisers and so on. And then the big reveal is, you know, the boss instead has to work as their slowly employee, and now they get to beg to keep their job and have to justify why they've been just living this life of luxury for so long while their employees have been toiling away in misery.
I don't even think it's an exaggeration to say that you have come in here today with much stronger takes about Undercover Boss than about Survivor Heroes versus Villains, but I applaud it. It was fantastic.
No, I will note that this is not representative of what this segment is usually like. Usually it's singing the praises of Greatest American Dog, which you should by all means check out, all of you out there.
All right. Well, there is coming this fall Undercover Boss. Dom, the final segment that I have this week, a quick one. A new segment, Date This Podcast. We're going to be giving something going on in the real world at the time that we're recording this so that the people listening to this, hopefully years from now, can have a fond memory. And at the time that this podcast is being recorded, this is going to tie in once again nicely to some whoring as we wrap up the podcast. Survivor 38 has just started filming in the real world. And incidentally, if you would like to hear our takes about what we know about that season so far, there's been some news that's come out about some returnees that may or may not be in play. There, Dom and I actually did an emergency podcast a little while ago, about a week or maybe in that neighborhood ago, talking through on the night that information broke our takes on how all of that was going to go. And so if you want to hear that is up on the Patreon feed, as well as parts one and now part three of Survivor Heroes versus Villains. So who knows what rant Dom has to go on in part three, but I'm looking forward to finding out, and you too can find out when you sign up now over at patreon.com/DomandColin. You will also find there over 13 hours of BB10 content. We just did a full rewatch of that. Dominic, anything else from you before we sign off for today?
I'm all done. I have to go back into hibernation and replenish the stock of hot takes before the next time we do this.
All right. Well, fantastic work. So excited to be back here very soon, continuing on with Heroes versus Villains. Thank you guys so much who made it this far into the podcast. And if you made it this far, one more time, patreon.com/Dom and Colin if you want to keep it going. I'm sure we will talk to you very soon. Go ahead, sorry.
And the big takeaway from Undercover Boss is pay people for their labor. So if you want to send a few dollars our way, you can find us on patreon.com/Dom and Colin. And if you want to get in touch with us, as Colin said, domandcolin@gmail.com or @colinstone@domhrv, there we go, on Twitter.
All right, fantastic. Thank you guys once again so much. I'm sure we'll talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.